When was the last time you felt inspired? Have you ever wanted to take your passions and use them to launch a successful business and enhance your life? Co-hosts Katana Abbott and Vicky Trabosh, who are both authors, coaches, and international speakers, bring to you experts in the field of personal and professional growth, wealth creation, and mind, body, and spirit for an opportunity to hear the top advice from the top resources. So grab a cup of coffee and take that quantum leap you've been waiting for. Smart Women Talk Radio, the link to live with purpose, passion, and prosperity.
Hi, everyone. This is Katana Abbott, and welcome to Smart Women Talk. I'm here with my wonderful co-host from Oregon, Vicky Trabosh. Hi, Vicky.
Good morning, Katana. And we want to welcome all our listeners to Smart Women Talk, where we search the world for best-selling authors, thought leaders, and change agents who are making a difference in the world. Our goal is to connect you with individuals who are on the leading edge to help you live more joyfully and prosperously in all areas of your life. You know, Katana, with over 75,000 subscribers now, our topics of money, starting and growing a business, health, creativity, and the metaphysical are really helping our listeners increase the prosperity of their lives and live extraordinary lives.
Oh, absolutely. And it's all made possible by our foundation, the Smart Women's Empowerment Program. And I'm just so thrilled that we were able to have the Smart Women Empowerment Foundation actually sponsor this show. It's a 501c3 charity. And, you know, I created that to help inspire and empower women and girls to, again, to live more joyful and confident lives and really focusing on financial literacy and entrepreneurship. So anyway, we have a wonderful new returning guest. His name is Rick Hansen, and he's actually a PhD, he's a doctor, and his book is Buddha's Brain. So I don't know how many of you, because we've grown so much since a year ago, how many were here last year, but I just had to bring him back, because he's got a phenomenal book that we're going to discuss how we're wired to overreact to emotionally threatening situations. And also, he's going to show us how to reverse the brain's bias towards being unhappy or towards negativity, and to reveal how acknowledging small but positive experiences in our daily lives can rewire the brain towards happiness. And also to share how to quit being driven by stress, because we have so much stress in our lives. So in a few minutes, we're gonna meet Rick personally. But for right now, what I want to do is this segment we have called the Smart Women Tip. And as you know, Vicky, we talked about this last week. She has this wonderful new book of wisdom coming out, and it's called Dead Rita's Wisdom. And she is going to be sharing with us tips from that, and I'll be sharing tips as well. But this week, we're going to have a tip from Vicky. So, Vicky, what's your tip, your Smart Women tip for us this week?
Well, Katana, when we talked about this, I was thinking about the book and all the amazing wisdom my mother gave me. And this woman who died at 67, about 20 years too soon by my estimation, was just this amazing, wise woman who shared everything she could with me, her daughter. And I always wanted to be like my mother. And she was petite and demure and quiet and shy. And then there's me. I must quit trying to be like her. And whether you try to be like a parent or someone else you know or a friend, there's this sense of dissatisfaction at all times when you're not enough. Well, one time I was about 39 years old. My parents were living with us, and I came home from work, and I do say the most outrageous things. I control myself pretty well on the show, I think, Katana, but I've been known to say outrageous things, and I had sent a doozy to someone. I don't even know who it was. And my mother, who was so proper, loved my outrageousness. And I came home and I said to her, "Oh, mother, you're not going to believe what I said." And she said, "What'd you say?" And I told her, I don't even remember what it was. And we roared. She just roared. And then I started to cry. And I said, "Oh, mother, what am I going to do?" And she said, "Oh, Vic, quit trying to be something you're not. Who you are is perfect." And you know, Katana, it took 39 years, But I finally heard that. And I realized I'll never be petite and shy and demure and quiet. I'm loud and bawdy and dramatic and all the things I am work. And, you know, the message, the smart tip today is quit trying to be something you're not. Be who you are. And that is enough.
And, you know, Vicki, there's so much fear associated with being ourselves. So if you think about it, you know, that being authentic, that we won't be accepted. So those are wise words, especially coming from your mom, because so often they tell us, you know, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't, you know, you need to be a different way. So I love that. Thank you so much.
And, you know, the other thing when you said that, it was so funny because my mother didn't know who she was. And she had grown up in an abusive situation, and my father was a tough marriage. But, you know, even if you don't know it yourself, you can tell other people, because my mother shared her wisdom and didn't always live it herself. But that's the other thing. It doesn't have to come from a perfect source. It doesn't have to come from someone who is necessarily doing it. But wisdom is wisdom. And that's why I'm so excited about our guest today, because his book, Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom, really puts context into why so many of the things that we know work, how they really come from a scientific standpoint. So I think we're going to have a great interview today.
Oh, I do too. I really do too. Well, you know, and I want to also point out, I just sent my newsletter out, Vicki. Did you get a copy of it?
I did. And it's very exciting about your trip.
I actually launched it. I put it out there to the world.
Well, the world needs to see this trip because it is just fantastic what you're going to do. Tell them a little more.
Well, I figure by the end of the, you know, after the getting the kids off to school or grandkids or, you know, getting back to work, because so many of us have different kind of schedules in the summer. And with all the holidays, getting towards first of the year, women really need to take some time now and schedule time off for themselves, time to rejuvenate and to really look at their life and their goals and their calling and their purpose. And what a fabulous place to do it, but in Costa Rica. So I've planned this retreat in Costa Rica, 8 days for 10 women. And we are going to go through the jungles. We're doing a shamanic experience with a real Mayan shaman at the Tabacan Spa with the water from the volcano. And we're going to do zip lines and extension bridges. We're going to, we have a goddess coach with us who's going to be doing leading us through yoga and meditations. But we're going to end this all at the ocean, where we're just going to, and the ocean is actually surrounded by jungle. It's not hotels. It's a very private, quiet place. So I hope that, I know that we are going to have an extremely wonderful experience. And the ladies that are signing up are all pretty magnificent too. So anyway, just one, if you want to check it out, it's smartwomengetaways.com, smartwomengetaways.com, and it will take you to the site.
Well, you know, and I'm so glad there's a little more time before it's coming up, because I'd really like to devote some time in a future show to really what, not just sort of the bullet list, but some of the experiences you've had and how they've changed your life and why you're so passionate about doing this.
You know what, too? I think just being in nature and learning to become present is a spiritual experience on its own. It does something to you.
Absolutely.
So, and those howler monkeys are pretty fun.
You know, in Rwanda, we call them gorillas. They're a little bigger than a howler monkey.
Oh, but these ones, I think, might be louder than a gorilla, believe it or not. It's amazing. they're pretty loud animals, and they're pretty scary. So I know that Rick is on the line, and we want to get him on here. But first, we're going to go to a quick break, and then we'll be right back to meet Rick Hansen.
Attention women in transition. Join financial goddess Katana Abbott and other leading coaches and entrepreneurs at www.smartwomenscafe.com. Take advantage of this free content and rich online community. Weekly coaching calls, teleclasses, and more with unparalleled access to top coaches are just some of the perks. or take it to the next level and check out the Business Mastermind Coaching Program for live coaching and over $9,500 in benefits. Learn to live with purpose, passion, and prosperity at smartwomenscafe.com.
Did you know that you can rate this show on iTunes? The show you're listening to right now. It's true. You can leave your thoughts about the show, the topic, the guest. You can even leave a suggestion. Then, before you leave, rate the show. The hosts love hearing from you, so next time you download this show from iTunes, leave your thoughts and rate the show for the host and for others.
This is Katana. Welcome back to Smart Women Talk. And I've got Rick Hansen here, but I want Vicki to tell you all about him.
Thanks, Katana. Dr. Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist and affiliate faculty of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. He's the author of the best-selling Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. This book has been published in 20 languages, and he is the founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. He's taught at Oxford, Stanford, and Harvard, and in meditation centers in Europe, North America, and Australia. To learn more about Rick, go to www.rickhanson.net. Welcome to our show, Rick.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Yeah, thanks so much. It has been about a year, but we had to bring you back because we want to share you with all of our new listeners. this is an amazing book. I mean, this is a very deep book, and there's so much going on right now where people are starting to learn. We just attended a Everything is Energy Telesummit recently, and people are really getting into the brain and the idea of energy and metaphysical. And in your book, you combine how psychology, neurology, and meditation all come into this play. How does meditation and mindfulness actually change our brain?
Great question. I mean, the famous saying in neuroscience is, neurons that fire together, wire together. I keep threatening to turn that into a rap song, but my wife says, honey, we'll pay you not to sing. But anyway, so neurons that fire together, wire together. It's the idea that, amazingly, what we think, what we feel, what we pay attention to, and what we do with what we pay attention to continually sculpts our own brain, for better or worse. That means that if we routinely rest our attention on, you know, self-criticism, self-doubt, beating ourselves up, or, you know, maintaining that kind of grumbling case about other people in the world and so forth, you know, the brain will take the shape over time of resentment, depression, anxiety, and vulnerability to stress. On the other hand, if we rest our attention or we rest our mind, we get those neurons firing together with regard to, you know, gratitude for the good things in life, a sense of, you know, the kindness of other people, their warmth, the little things we get done every day, a load of laundry, getting the kids to bed, surviving our childhood, ain't dead yet, you know, all the rest of that, then the brain will take a different shape and a shape of, you know, happiness, well-being, confidence, strength, and so forth. So the takeaway is that people can routinely use their mind alone in skillful ways. That's what my book's about. It's about the specifics of this, how to skillfully use your mind alone to change your brain for the better, to change your mind for the better, and therefore change your life for the better over time.
So, Rick, you talk about the brain and the mind. Are they the same, or how do they relate? And can you explain the difference or the similarities or how they work together?
Yeah, and I can even say more about the part of, you know, how does mindfulness and meditation change the brain? Because there's been a lot of research on that, which is kind of cool. Mind is broadly defined as information, as all the information that's represented by, stored in, and worked on by the physical nervous system. That may sound a little funny at first, but if you think about it, there are thousands of examples around us. For example, a computer hard drive is physical, but what it does is represent not physical information. A traffic light, you know, the colors, you know, red, yellow, and green, are in a sense physical or material, in the sense that energy is part of the material universe. But the meaning of red, yellow, and green is not physical. I mean, arbitrarily, we could make red go, you know, and green stop, for example. So in the same way, the nervous system has information in it, most of which is outside of our awareness. It has information like how to move through food through the intestines or take a deeper breath or reach for a cup or catch a ball, let alone information at the highest level like love or spiritual experiences or aspiration or being upset, being anxious, being sad, being angry. All that is information. The thing that's amazing is, though, is that the physical processes of the nervous system and the information processes of the mind happen at the same time. They co-arise. So as the brain changes, the mind changes, but also through what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity, as the mind changes, so does the brain. This means that it's really important for people to be aware of, that's where mindfulness really comes in, what are you experiencing? What are you indulging inside your own head, you know? Because it leaves traces behind for better or worse. It also gives us tremendous power to use our mind to change our brains for the better.
You know, what I love about what you said is, and it's not just because it was one of the last things you said, but it sounds that way. What are you indulging in? You know, one of the expressions I use, wherever your attention lies, there truly lies your intention.
Yeah.
And that this idea of indulgence, or awfulizing, you know, there's so many ways to put this, where we spend our time, whether we're awfulizing or whether we're focused on the positive. And I think some people who have become skeptical of this idea think that it's all about just going to a happy place in your mind and that's enough. How do you help people understand that there is something about a happy place, but it's not a quick fix? How do you explain
right.
that
it's not
to
Pollyanna,
people?
It's not superficial.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would say two things about it fast. The first is that attention is kind of like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. In other words, it illuminates what it rests upon and then, you know, sucks it into your brain. That's because, yes, neurons that wire together throughout the nervous system, they do so particularly, they're turbocharged, you know, for what's in the field of focused attention. The problem is most people don't have very good control of that spotlight, you know. We both evolved a kind of skittery attention because that's how you keep animals alive in the wild. And also today we have a real ADD sort of culture. We're bombarded with stimuli continually. We get used to needing a lot of stimuli. We're surrounded by distractions, multitasking, emails, you know, juggling kids, jobs, partnership, the whole nine yards. Anyway, the net of that is that we typically don't have good control of attention, and that's where mindfulness training comes in, in one way or another. I mean, meditation is a great training of attention, even for a minute or more a day. It's perfectly fine to modify traditional instructions so that they're more stimulating, like walking or while doing daily tasks, doing the dishes, cradling a child, walking the dog, you know, just simply getting dressed in the morning can be a meditative practice that trains attention. Or we can bring that kind of attention to other things like Pilates or yoga or just hanging out with friends. So it's important, I think, as a fundamental skill to train attention. I mean, it's the education par excellence, as William James, the godfather of American psychology, said about a century ago. So that's point one. Point two, I think that growth, healing, and spiritual practice has three basic phases to it. The first phase is we be with what's there. We're mindful of it. In the second phase, we let it go if it's hurtful or problematic or full of suffering. And then in the third phase, we replace what we've released with something more positive. All three phases are important. I think the first phase is most important. People tend to skip over it, me included. Often guys do because we just want a quick fix, ba-boom. But there's no traction if you jump to the quick fix. You've got to hang out with it. The point, though, is that if you hang out with it past the point that's helpful, in other words, if you just sort of notice you're angry, notice you're upset, notice you're frustrated, okay, be mindful of that for a while, but past the kind of Goldilocks point, you know, just the just right spot, not too tall, not too short, not too hot, not too cold. If you're just dwelling on negative experiences past the point that's productive for you, it's like doing one more lap in hell, you know, going around the track, digging it a little deeper each time you go, because neurons that fire together wire together for worse as well as for better, you know. And that's where the research on positive emotions comes in, because if we are active in our own mind, that's good in its own right, because as mammals, we're very vulnerable. I think women in particular, because of their way they're socialized and raised as a generalization, are vulnerable to a sense of futility or being constrained or defeated or helpless, let's say. So it's very important to move against that, if only by being active inside your own head, because sometimes that's the only place where you can have a sense of efficacy, where you're a hammer instead of a nail. Then, though, it's important to cultivate positive emotion because it makes people more resilient. You know, it's like they say in the airlines, put your own oxygen mask on first. By taking in resources to yourself, but getting your own cup to brimmeth over, then you've got more to offer to your family, your friends, and the whole world. And, of course, you have rights of your own. You know, oftentimes people underestimate the importance of feeling good, but happiness is skillful means. And there are literally hundreds of studies on the physical and mental health benefits of positive emotion that bear this out.
Like they can create endorphins in the body, for example, just being in a state of joy. You know, I want you to give us an example for this, is I really believe in creating a daily practice and actually, you know, writing down, creating what are the things that bring me joy that I want to make sure I do in my life, and then putting it into my calendar and creating a daily practice around it. And so when you were talking about the mindfulness, letting go, replacing, you know, I see that as that time that I spend by myself where I become present and then I notice, I try to be in nature, but I notice what's around me, but then I notice also my body and how I'm feeling, but I try not to go out and go, you know, with my mind going, but I try to be very present in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think of those three phases succinctly in six words, you know, let be, let go, let in. And all three are important. People typically, I think, are weakest at the third phase, letting in. And I think that as a generalization is particularly true for women who are so trained in a way to take care of others first, you know, before they let in positive experiences or resources into themselves. And a key point here is that most positive experiences are mild. It's perfectly fine for it to be a mild sense of gratitude or ease or peacefulness or relief, frankly, or basic well-being. And one of the practices that I think is really important, I actually have a chapter on it in the book, it's called Taking in the Good, and it's very much like what you just said there. It's to, you know, take opportunities multiple times a day and even in specific moments, you know, like a moment at each meal or a moment just before bed or a moment on waking, take specific moments to do what I call the three steps of taking in the good. You know, number one, let a good fact become a good experience. That's a key right there. You know, lots of times good things happen, but we don't feel it particularly. It doesn't move the needle. Second is to stay with it, savor it for 15, 30 seconds in a row. That's critically important because, as we'll get into it later, I'm sure, the brain has a negativity bias that makes it like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. This means that negative experiences get registered instantly in implicit memory. You know, once burned, twice shy, but positive experiences have plain old memory systems which require a lot of repetition to transfer information to long-term storage. So by staying with it for 15, 30 seconds in a row, really letting yourself marinate, you know, in some kind of well-being, that's how you get those neurons to really fire together so they wire together. And then the third step to taking in the good is to sense and intend that it sink in. You know, that's a way of priming memory systems. The point is that as you go through life, there are dozens of little opportunities every day, even in a stressful, challenged life. You know, my first book was about taking good care of mothers over the long haul. You know, I've got two young adult kids. I've been in the business world. I get it about the real world. Nonetheless, there are lots of little moments. I think of them as little pearls on the ground strewn before us that we tend to be completely oblivious to. But I say, take a vacuum cleaner, you know, suck them into yourself every day.
You know, I want to, for I'm sure we have some some listeners who are skeptical of this whole idea. And I'd like your thoughts. I want to kind of explain something that I experience often. And to your point that makes it so real, I go to Rwanda. I have a foundation for Rwanda called the Itafari Foundation. And I have been traveling to Rwanda for the last 5 years on a very regular basis. And one of the things that happened in Rwanda was this genocide in 1994 when 1 million people died in 100 days. And as I was listening to you, I was thinking about the mindful piece that you must realize what has truly happened. But then this let it be, the let be piece. I really, if you don't go to Rwanda, often when I meet people, they'll say, oh, God, that must be horrible. I say, no. It's the most amazing place with the most resilient people, because not only have they experienced the genocide, they are truly, as they can, as their bodies can let it release, they are letting go of their pain and they are replacing it with resilience. And one of the things that I often experience there, I'll go to meetings in the morning. I'll meet with companies I coach there as well as work on our programs for the foundation. They start their morning. People show up for work between 7:30 and 8, and they all gather in a room, and then they begin to sing, and they sing and they pray and they praise, and someone will get up from the office and give a little quote sermon, and they're often religious based. There's a lot of religion, faith in Rwanda. And, you know, I never cease to leave those meetings, and it's hot already. It's warm, kind of sticky. People are going to their offices. But you watch the energy change and all these people who walk in sleepy like we all do to work. And I often think about how we have lost that in the United States. We've lost this process, this period of time where we really become mindful and also find joy. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about those extreme situations that people have gone through and how your process applies for them, given sort of this example.
Sure. Well, first, thank you for doing that. You know, really from my heart, I was blown away myself when I became aware of what had actually happened in Rwanda. And, you know, there's stories that you know much better than I that are just, that just stop your heart cold, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So incredible. Well, a couple of things here. First, I think there's a spectrum of uses for techniques or methods for changing the brain better over time. I mean, most of the time, certainly in, I think probably most people listening to the show, we're going to be using them for, you know, relatively mild to moderate stressors, painful experiences, wounds, deficits, or we're going to be using them to really focus on enhancing, you know, quality of life and building up resources inside, including the resources that can make this world a better place. It's also true, though, that these kind of methods are very appropriate and they're foundational, really, for dealing with, you know, major issues, because gradually over time, you're changing your brain. You know, it's the brain that's constructing our suffering, right? It's the brain that carries within it the impact of traumatic experience. So it's the brain where we have to make the change. And by the brain, really, I'm talking about changes that then cascade through the whole body. You know, as was said previously, in terms of hormones like or neurotransmitters like endorphins, you know, affecting cardiovascular systems, GI systems, and all the rest. So the point here is that, as I've seen and listened to people who talk about dealing with recovery from trauma, one of the keys there is finding positive, not so much necessarily finding positive or meaning in what happened, although that's actually powerful for some people who can do that, but finding what's positive and meaningful in daily life since then. You know, the sun is still rising, you know, flowers are still blooming, children are still laughing, you know, chocolate still tastes good, right? Life is ongoing. And for me, it's very critical to be active in one's own life and not defeated. You know, I think about the fairly well-known passage from Viktor Frankl's memoir of Life in Auschwitz, which I think is tied with Rwanda and probably some other things as dead last, you know, or tied for first place as hell on earth. Anyway, Viktor Frankl said that in Auschwitz there were always some people who, one way or another, to paraphrase him here, demonstrated that most fundamental of human freedoms, the freedom to choose how we will respond to our circumstances, even if our circumstances are awful. And, you know, I've been a therapist for a really long time, and it's made me both much more compassionate, but it's made me much more tough-minded, because I see routinely that people will work hard at things that they say are not that important. You know, they'll work hard at fussing around their house with housework, or, you know, working on their golf game, or getting better at the latest version of Microsoft Word or something like that. And yet they will not work very much at things that they say are important, like becoming a more skillful partner, mate, parent, or more skillful with their own thoughts, feelings, and emotional reactions. And that doesn't make sense to me. To me, what's important, you know, is to work hard at the things that matter the most. And to have confidence, in this case, based on science, hardcore, super hardcore science, that if you work hard in little ways every day, you know, not white-knuckling it, but in little nudges, a handful of times every day, if you do that work, if you make that effort, you will gradually change your brain for the better over time.
Explain this whole thing about, because I remember you saying something about physically changing the brain, because we've had a lot of people on who talk about this idea of the meditation and, you know, being present, and that we can, you know, and I do the whole thing with the gratitude and taking little breaks in the day. But I never, ever thought about this concept of it doing physical changes in the brain that become permanent. Is it permanent?
Oh, yeah. I'll give you some examples of that. I mean, for one, if you just think about it, anytime you learn something, whether it's riding a bike or, you know, remembering back to something that happened in your childhood, or, you know, maybe internalizing some kind of psychological growth, you know, listening to your most excellent show, people grow. They learn. That's the point. Well, where is learning embedded in the body? You know, if the computer learns something, the hard drive has to change in some way. In the same way, scientists have presumed for well over a century that if we learn something, the brain has to change in some way. So that's point one. Point two, the how of it occurs in lots of ways. For one, the brain changes temporarily or momentarily as mental activity changes. For example, if you meditate or fall asleep, or on the other hand, get stressed and frustrated and irritated and angry, brainwave pattern changes. Brainwave patterns change, which means that different groups of neurons are firing together in different ways. Other temporary changes include flows of neurotransmitters. Let's say a mother holding her baby to her breast. That creates lots of flows of oxytocin. On the other hand, if people get excited and revved up, that's going to produce adrenaline and norepinephrine running through the brain that are arousing and stimulating. These are examples of temporary changes. Other temporary changes are different parts of the brain light up when you do different things. For example, if people are paying attention, a part of the brain called the frontal cingulate cortex gets busy, because that's, that helps us control our attention. Or, for example, if people are tuning into their bodies, doing yoga, or being empathic for the feelings of others, that all lights up a different part of the brain called the insula that's involved in self-awareness. Okay, those are temporary changes. Now, permanent changes happen through practice and repetition. For example, London taxi cab drivers, a study showed, who have to memorize and visualize the spaghetti snarl of streets there in London, have a measurably thicker hippocampus. That's a part of the brain that's involved in visual spatial memory. The hippocampus also puts the brakes on the alarm bell of the brain, which is called the amygdala. So you can see the effect. You know, these taxi cab drivers worked that quote-unquote muscle in their brain, the hippocampus, doing visual spatial activities, so at the end of their training, it was measurably thicker. In other examples, people who routinely meditate have a thicker frontal cingulate cortex, just like I said, because they're training their attention repeatedly. It's literally, they're building up synapses, new synapses are forming, new capillaries bringing blood with supplies like oxygen and glucose go into regions that are being worked and developed. Existing synapses that are being worked become sensitized so that they're more responsive. Those are some of the many mechanisms that occur. There are also epigenetic changes that occur, changes in the expression of genes. For example, studies have shown that people who routinely relax have improved expression of the genes that control the stress response. Little strips of atoms, you know, amazingly, inside a larger twisted up molecule of DNA get unwrapped based on the mental experience of relaxation so that those particular genes can do their work better. Also, people who routinely meditate have a thicker insula, which is the part of the brain I mentioned previously that's involved in both self-awareness, especially for kind of the core of our experience in the body and in deep emotions, and it's involved in empathy for the emotions of others. So you get a nice two-for-one benefit there.
But what I want you to add to that is, so how does that, like, for the average person, how does that benefit us in our everyday life, like, permanently? Like, how can we use that? So we meditate, and it's going to then do what? Like, what is the benefit?
Like I said, it trains your attention. So it's building a muscle. You go to the gym, it benefits. When you go to the gym, how does it benefit you? It benefits you by making your heart stronger, strengthening your immune system, building up various muscles. In the same way, when you do mental practices, that benefits you by building up the quote-unquote muscles, as it were, inside the brain that do those things. So you become, for example, if you meditate, let's say, you become better at controlling your attention. You get more control of that spotlight. That's important. You build up the circuits that do that. Or, for example, you build up the circuits that enable you to tune into yourself and know yourself more deeply. And also you build up the circuits that enable you in the insula to tune more into other people. So the general idea, in a way, it's really like going to the gym, you know, or doing exercise or some kind of physical thing in daily life. You know, if you use it, you make it stronger. You build it up.
So as I think about what you're saying, and Katana touched on it as well, for those listening, and this is, you really have the science behind it. But this is the question, as I look at the book sitting here in front of me, if you could explain to our listeners who haven't read it, why do you call this Buddha's brain?
Oh, sure. Well, the key for me about the book, you know, Buddha's brain, is about methods. It's about things you can do. That's what it's chock full of. And I think, you know, to my happy amazement, that's why it's still extremely popular 2 years almost after I wrote it, because it's so practical. That's the thing I really want to stress for people. For me, what I'm interested in, I'm a methods guy. You know, I have a lot of academic training. I consume that research really well, but I don't do it. I'm a clinician. I'm a practicing therapist, a practicing meditation teacher, and a practicing father and husband, and a practicing citizen of America, God help us, you know, in the 21st century. And so, you know, I'm interested in real stuff that you can do, trapped in traffic or trying to get a two-year-old into a car seat, one of the most struggling, stressful experiences known to humankind.
So true.
You know? Yeah. What can you do on this? But, so that's what my book is so full of, including things related to relationships and so forth. So, for me, that's the key point here. And then, why did I call it Buddha's brain? You know, I think the Buddha is, for many people, an example of someone who, kind of outside the frame of religion, really, who really trained himself without asking anyone to take anything on faith alone. He trained his own mind over time to a very great perfection, really, of happiness, love, and wisdom. And so for me, if you want to get good at anything, whether it's cooking or golf or figuring out how to put toddlers in a car seat, study people who are good at it, right? Model the people that are good at it. You know, that's why I think, you know, one reason why people listen to you both, because you're good at things and they're learned from you, you know? So for me, in the same way, let's study the people who are really good at well-being or who are really good at love, including, you know, connecting and integrating love and strength. Or look at the people who have a lot of spiritual wisdom, particularly grounded in real things, you know, down to earth, useful in day-to-day life. Let's study those folks, and then with science, which is really amazing these days, figure out what's going on in their brains. Because then, if we start understanding better, and scientists are, what's happening in the brain when people are in a really good place, then we can stimulate those neural circuits, as it were. And by stimulating them, we strengthen them. Because just like building a muscle in the gym, neurons that fire together wire together.
You know, as you were speaking about this, I was thinking about Gabrielle Gifford, who showed up yesterday for the vote, and who she was before the shooting, and how she has come through that. I mean, it was such an emotional thing. Even listening to her showing up on the floor of the house was so emotional as I was driving and I wasn't there, just listening to the applause. And I don't know what that's about, right? We don't know if it's the energy or the love that she felt. But a woman who has been through so much, and you watch, to your point about how do we use the best parts of who we are in our brain to come through something. She is an amazing woman who suffered a terrible tragedy. And here she is coming through this with more success than, say, a woman or man who had prior to that, not because of, but prior to a tragedy, also looked at the world different, which for me is the bell that says, hey, this is important before you suffer anything. This is important to start a lifestyle that absolutely will get you through the toughest times going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think of, she's a remarkable example of some of the extremes of training the brain. And mm-hmm. to me, what's humbling, is to think kind of on two levels. First, if she has been able to recover physically, there's been a lot of rehab on her brain, a lot of treatment, as it were, on it as an organ. If you think about it, like a heart or a kidney, or a knee. Well, you got a brain's an organ. So they've done a lot of physical changes in her brain, right? And if you can get that large a change in a brain as in her, gosh, it gives us lots of reason to believe that we can get smaller but still very personally important changes in our own brain. The other thing for me that's humbling and inspiring is to appreciate how hard she's worked, just mm-hmm. In terms of her own rehab, in terms of dealing with what life has thrown her here and how she's come through. And to me, right there, it says, gosh, if I work even a fraction that hard, if she can work that hard, why can't I work at least half as hard? You know what I mean? Or a quarter
Absolutely.
As hard in daily life. Yeah.
Well, one of the things you have in your book that I think is so helpful is that you do speak to the power of meditation, but you have a number of meditations in your book that are really there to guide people. Can you talk a little bit about those? As you said, you talked about the practical parts of your book, and I know Katana is going to be closing us up in a minute here, but can you talk a little bit about why you chose to put the meditations in the book and what your intention is with those?
Oh, sure. There are a number of guided practices that have to do, for example, with, experiencing greater mindfulness, or a number of, kind of brain smart methods for getting more control over your attention, because that's not that easy to do. So for me, I put in lots of things you can do to kind of build up the fundamentals of becoming more mindful and learning how to steady your mind, and also, in a sense, dropping the keel in the water deeper so you're more emotionally stable and less rattled by daily life. That's also where I have a lot of methods in there for stress relief, feeling more relaxed, and also recovering faster from feeling anxious or frustrated or inadequate or sad or even depressed. Because to me, it's important to be able to deal with those negative emotions too. I also have a lot in there that's in a sense meditative, but it actually goes deeper than that, because I have a lot in there about dealing with other people, when you're upset with them or trying to assert yourself with them or trying to understand themselves or understand them better. It's very possible to build up skills literally inside your own brain again that give you more sense of inner strength so you can be more assertive while also remaining, kind and connected to the other person. You may need to put them out of your company or your bed, but you don't need to put them out of your heart. So for me, that's actually, I have a background in meditation that's important. But I live in the real world. We're not monastics, right? How many minutes or even let alone hours a day do people routinely have an opportunity to meditate? For me, what's so important is what we do off the cushion, as it were. What we do in daily life in terms, and that's what I focus tons and tons of, skills and methods and tips and how-tos, et cetera, in the book on, how to get that toddler in the car seat without losing your cool, how to hang strong when your partner's letting you down yet again, how to still find happiness even though you had a rocky childhood, how to inspire yourself to sustain the course if you're starting a business or you know, trying to grow your business or just deal with the economy these days. You know, for
well,
me,
you're getting so many nails on the head, Rick. You just said, bam.
Oh, yeah.
All those bullets. Whoa. I think that probably just hit so many of our listeners. Can you give us an example? Because what you're saying is so powerful, and all of us need help with it. Can you just walk us through like a sample meditative or just a mindfulness technique that we can use today when the show is over and something happens?
Sure. I'll give you a couple things, and I'll do it sort of halfway between just naming it and walking people through it, because, you know, we got to move on here, I'm sure. Well, one is simply, it's so important these days when we're experiencing a lot of chronic stress, which we did not evolve to handle. You know, in the wild, stressful episodes ended quickly, one way or another, right? But these days, we're subject to a lot of low-grade, even moderate but chronic stress. So it's very important to learn to activate what's called the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calming, cooling, soothing wing of the nervous system. One quick trick for doing that I really love is to do several long exhalations. In other words, make the exhalation about twice as long as the inhalation. People even just try it right now. You know, you inhale roughly a count of three and then exhale roughly a count of six. You know, people will usually immediately experience a significant sense of relaxation and ease. That's because the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system handles the exhaling. A second suggestion I'd offer to people is to repeat what I said previously about taking in the good. Look for multiple opportunities to really savor and register and internalize good experiences half a dozen times a day, you know, 30 seconds at a time. And if you want to, you can especially look for the key experiences, your own personal vitamin C, that will fill the hole in your heart. I mean, for me growing up, I was very young going through school. I felt like a dorkish outsider because I was. And so I had a lot of hurt inside about feeling not seen or feeling excluded and not wanted or not valued. And so later in life as a young adult, I would look for lots of opportunities that were based on facts to feel included, prized, you know, cherished, and so forth. So if you know what your own vitamin C is, what your heart longs for, or what would have made all the difference in the world, let's say in your last relationship or job or in your childhood, you can look for that and then particularly take that in. The third thing I'll say, maybe just wrapping up here, is to look for opportunities to feel cared about. You know, as we evolved, exile was a death sentence in the Serengeti. It's so important for us. We're the most social species on the planet. It's so important for us to have little moments of feeling cared about. The relationship doesn't need to be perfect. It doesn't need to be a perfect love. But in at least one major slice of the pie of that relationship, the other person in question likes you, wishes you well. You matter to them, okay? I even think of guys who make my, you know, salad across the street, you know, I go to in the deli. We hang out. We joke. We talk about baseball. I know they like me. That's an opportunity to feel cared about, let alone, you know, my wife in nearly 30 years. And so if people just take a moment, you know, 10, 20, 30 seconds in a row, get those neurons firing together to feel cared about in the presence of someone who's caring, that's a very important way to weave resources inside yourself. You know, to sum up, as we go through life, we continually pour out. You know, I think that's particularly true for women. As you might know, I'm a major fan of women. You know, I'm a guy. I'm a guy's guy. I like my remote control and all the rest of that, my power tools. But when I think of what women deal with routinely, I feel so grateful to them. You know, it's for many people, men included, obviously, we pour out, and then we start running on empty. You know, it's so important, both for our own well-being and also to develop resources inside that we can use to help others and make the world a better place, you know, to take in, to fill our cup up. Otherwise, like I said, we start running on fumes.
So taking these little breaks during the day can be very helpful. I have a question for you. There are CDs that they have out now, and even I have a home study course I did with a shaman where she made an MP3 of her playing the drum, you know, the American Indian drum, you know, and she says it stimulates the theta brainwave. Is there any benefit to actually playing these CDs that have the that take you from like beta, alpha, theta, delta, that they say they take you there manually without you having to try to go there in a meditation.
Yeah, I think they are good. And I think like a lot of new things, you know, on the one hand, there are two pitfalls. You know, on the one hand, the pitfall of just sort of dogmatically rejecting them because they're innovative, on the one hand. On the other hand, the pitfall of because you have a nice hammer, everything starts looking like a nail, right? And so to me, the point about them is I've known that some people get benefit from them. I've known others who don't like them. And I think a lot of it, honestly, is just try it and see if it works for you. There is some research generally. It's pretty soft research, but just because there's no research doesn't mean that something's not valid. You know, there is beginning research even about those technologies. I also think it's true that as people, go through daily life, there are many opportunities, even without, you know, listening to a DVD or doing something kind of formal in terms of practice, there's so many opportunities to take a breath, you know, gather yourself, call up. This is another practice. I'll just mention another specific one that I think is very important for people, to call up a felt sense of strength, maybe by remembering times when you were strong, you know, whether it was doing that last repetition of weight in the gym or maybe a time when you really stood up for somebody else or stood up for yourself. You know, call up that felt sense of strength. And then on the heels of it, call up a growing sense of relative safety. You know, most of us are going around in a state of paper tiger paranoia where we feel like the world is threat level orange. And instead of that, it's important to feel, you know, as safe as you reasonably can. For example, notice you're all right now. Sometimes you're not all right. Like if you're in Rwanda and you're, you know, being attacked, you're not all right now, let's say. But much of the time, people actually are all right now. So noticing that and registering it and let yourself feel it, you know, is a very good way to help yourself feel safer, which is so important. You know, we can afford, most of us most of the time, to be less guarded, less braced, and less anxious about life, and more open-hearted and courageous. So to me, those are some additional practices. You know, I go into a lot more detail in the book, but those are additional practices people can do.
Yeah, and all of this is so wonderful, and we have to wrap, and but I want to thank you for coming back and sharing this and bringing us all these soft tools along with the science behind it. So, Rick, thank you so much.
And Rick, this is Vicki. I want to thank you as well. I know your book is only in 20 languages. I do not know why it is not in the language of Kinyarwanda. I'll be going to Rwanda at the end of August, and I'm going to take your book with me. There's so many people I work with there that this book is terrific for those that are healing. And so thank you for that. And thank you for your time with us today. We have so appreciated it.
Oh, you guys are great. And I really wish everyone listening to this, I really wish you all the very best.
Oh, thank you so much. And next week, we'll be interviewing Bonnie Michaels, who is an internationally recognized speaker, author, and consultant on her book, Upside, How to Zig When Life Zags. And she'll provide solutions and strategies for sustainable success. So for our listeners, if you would just take all of our great speakers and put them together, life is good. That's all I can say.
Oh, yeah. And make sure if you get a chance to sign up for the iTunes, because you can take them to the road. I just got an iPad and I'm trying to figure out how to do all this. But I cannot wait to figure out how to take these with me, because I feel trapped that I have to be at this big old computer to enjoy these, because I love going back and listening to the shows and also all the other shows that are on Contact Talk Radio. So I want to mention something else too. August is an amazing month of speakers, ladies and gentlemen. We have coming up Barbara Stanny, and also she's America's. She's a best-selling author of Prince Charming Isn't Coming, Overcoming Under-Earning, and and Secrets of Six-Figure Women, and Christine Arilo. So mark your calendar for at least the next 2 weeks. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week on Smart Women Talk. Come visit us on the homepage. And with that, we are going to wrap up with Go Out and Live with More Purpose, Passion, and Prosperity.
Thank you for joining us here at Smart Women Talk Radio, a place to learn, prosper, and grow. Tune in again next week for another exciting episode of Smart Women on the CTR Network. And remember to live with purpose, passion, and prosperity.